Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Italian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Gary Milligan, your host. Today we'll be talking to Eva del Soldato, the author of Early Modern Aristotle, On the Making and Unmaking of Authority, which was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2020. Professor del Soldato is Associate Professor of Romance Languages at the University of Pennsylvania. She also serves as the Executive Secretary of the American Association of Italian Studies. She has received many fellowships, including those from the Scuola Normale Superiore, Harvard's Villitatti, the Herzog August Bibliothek, the Huntington Library, and the University of Warwick, where she was a Marie Curie Fellow. In addition to the book we are discussing today, she has published a monograph on Simone Porzio, the 16th century Italian philosopher, a translation of Bessarion's In Calumniatorum Platonis, and has co-edited the volume City, Court, Academy, Language Choice in Early Modern Italy. Eva, welcome. I'm truly delighted to speak with you today.
Thank you, Jerry. It's a real pleasure for me as well.
Great. Thanks for taking the time out to speak with me. So your book, as the title, or rather as the subtitle suggests, looks at the practice of establishing or challenging Aristotle's authority in the early modern period. And I really found it informative for my own work on women in the Renaissance, which I do hope we'll get to in a bit. But before we dive into your book and the early modern period, it might be helpful if you would just briefly explain how and to what extent Aristotle's authority had been established in the Middle Ages.
Thank you so much. This is indeed a great question. So it's quite fascinating because in the ancient period, Aristotle was mostly considered a student of Plato, and he was read by many ancient interpreters precisely according to this perspective. And then instead, during the Middle Ages, he raised as the main authority, mostly because of the institutional role that he came to cover in the university milieu. That didn't happen by chance. That happened because Aristotle was the perfect actor for university, for teaching, for pedagogy. Why? Because Aristotle had written basically about everything, so he had an encyclopedia that could be useful precisely for these pedagogical purposes. And when he was writing these treatises, that again, we should enter in the story of the Aristotelian corpus, but let's call them treatises. These treatises, indeed, were written according to a structure that was friendly for teaching. It was working very well in a pedagogical settings, precisely because they were treatises, they were offering answers. Unlike Plato, for example, that having written dialogues, which were often without any real resolution at the end, weren't so suitable for university teaching and teaching in general. And all these aspects made him, therefore, perfect to be the authority of reference in that milieu. And consequently, establish him as the philosopher par excellence. It's not by chance that when we call off when we discuss Aristotle, when we speak about Aristotle, he's the philosopher in capital P. And this is because he was basically the handbook for any kind of higher instruction. At the same time, of course, these reception of Aristotle in the Middle Ages was also mediated by the fact that we were in a Christian context, and evidently some accommodations and manipulation were needed in order to make this pagan philosopher suitable also in such a different context. But that would not change in the Renaissance. What will change in the Renaissance, indeed, will be the fact that other philosophers will be rediscovered and the approach itself on the Aristotelian text will change.
It's so interesting to think of his popularity based on it sounds like you're suggesting on a style a difference in style versus, let's say, Plato's dialogues. How important it was for pedagogy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is why there was these extensive program in translating the Corpus Aristotelicum from Greek or from Arab and Hebrew into Latin, precisely because there was demand for this kind of text. It is interesting that instead, during the Middle Ages, we basically had no Plato. We only had two full works by Plato translated into Latin, and two which were translated partially, but otherwise very little. And Plato was known mostly through mediation of Neoplatonic authors or through St. Augustine. Well, instead, in the case of Aristotle, we really could have his entire corpus.
Mm. You know, your book so wonderfully addresses the question of, as we mentioned, authority, and how, as you call him, the philosopher with the capital P, and how he either retains the capital P or it gets, maybe the capital P gets challenged. What drew you to focus on this question of authority?
That's a great question.
Well, on the capital P.
Of course. Well, you know, I will give you this reply. It was really a matter of connecting the dots. I was working for a long time in European libraries, collecting great materials about the Aristotelian tradition in the early modern period. And I was wondering, well, maybe I can publish articles about this subject and so on. While instead, at one point, it occurred to me that all these texts I was collecting really had the fil rouge that was involving them all. And that problem was the fact that Aristotle as an authority was either challenged or defended in these writings. So the fact that Aristotle has to be defended and presented as a good Christian, or the fact that Aristotle is challenged precisely because, no, he's not a Christian, so he's dangerous for us, and so on. Why so much contention for a guy who died so many centuries ago? Mm-hmm. So what interested me really was why there was such a heated debate about defending the good reputation or attacking and destroying the reputation of this individual. There have been excellent studies like those by Craig Martin about the fact that in the early modern period, we are witnessing an attempt of subverting the authority of Aristotle. And I was interested in putting together the two sides of the question. While on one side, we want to subvert Aristotle after he served the needs of several groups for such a long time, and at the same time, why do we want to protect this authority, and which agendas are at play when this happens?
Well, you know, I think you, in the introduction of the book, you really nicely lay out how authority can make us think of these questions beyond even Aristotle, and what it means to have an authority and how it suits these agendas of the writers. It really is such a fascinating approach. And you know, the way you do it, in at least in the first three chapters, is to discuss this genre, which I have to admit, as I am not a philosopher, of the comparatio, is something that I found new to, not somewhat new to me. I mean, I knew it existed, but certainly not to the extent in which you present. So in the first three chapters, you tell us about this comparatio genre. So why don't you explain what that is, particularly in the Greek origin that you lay out in chapter one?
Yeah, thank you. As I was mentioning before, in the ancient period, Aristotle was considered mostly a student of Plato. And this relationship between the two philosophers led many thinkers to consider Plato and Aristotle in perfect agreement, even when the writings were showing us something different. The solution that was offered in order to reconcile the two authors was to say that while Plato was a theologian and therefore discussing divine realities, Aristotle was instead the natural philosopher discussing the sublunar world. So in this way, there was no conflict at all. They were simply offering complementary views of the world. And at the same time, it was possible even to claim that they were in perfect agreement. Again, that happened for practical reasons. In schools of philosophy, it was useful to rely on someone like Aristotle writing in such a clear way, clearer than Plato, because again, dialogues are often obscure. And it was considered like a sort of Plato for dummies, I might say, in the sense that he really represented a gateway for younger scholars before approaching the deep truths of the Platonic philosophy. So those were the origins of the genre, in the sense that these people teaching in the ancient schools of philosophy in Greece wanted to show the agreement of the two philosophers for pedagogical purposes.
Could you then possibly, I'm sorry to interrupt, but would you mind like laying out what one of these might look like? Because this is where I'm curious. Is it a, you said Plato for dummies, but is it a now let me explain Plato, now let me explain Aristotle side by side, or because I haven't seen these texts.
So the thing is basically that Aristotle was praised for his logical abilities, while instead those were aspects missing in considered missing instead in Platonic works. And at the same time, the fact that Aristotle discussed lower realities was useful precisely because these lower realities were seen as opening a path to understand the supralunar divine realities. And the text in themselves, you know, we mostly have fragments. Mm-hmm. We do not have entire works that put these things in display. We have mostly the writings of Simplicius, and the writings of Simplicius are the most useful testimony probably of this kind of approach, and which wasn't initiated by him in any case. We know that Porphyry, for example, wrote two works, which are both lost, completely lost, on the agreement of Plato and Aristotle. But in the writings of Simplicius, who was an Aristotelian commentator, we find the real attempt of demonstrating that these two authors could seem to disagree at an exterior view, but that at the deeper level were instead in agreement, precisely because they were occupying different level of the realities and therefore weren't really conflicting on something. They were simply speaking of different things. And Simplicius really says these things in his commentaries on Aristotle's works. And Simplicius is, in fact, the most influential source also for many Renaissance authors. But before arriving to the Renaissance, we have to go through the treatment of the comparatio, which is offered during the Byzantine period. So as you can see, there is a Greek pattern in this story. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the Byzantine period, we have a triangulation between Plato, Aristotle, and Christianity. So the problem is, who is the author who is most suitable to support Christian religion? And in that case, the reply is not in favor of Aristotle. Plato is still considered the most pious philosopher. Plato is considered the philosopher that went closer to the Christian truth. So in many of these Byzantine, later Greek authors, we find instead Plato having the upper hand on Aristotle. And then what happened? That these Greeks came to Italy for the Council of Ferrara Florence. And in that moment, we have a clash of words between a Latin word that has been until that moment dominated basically by the Aristotelian philosophy in all its treatments, including, of course, the one by Thomas Aquinas and all the scholastics. And on the other side, this Greek philosopher that until that moment have looked upon Plato like the philosopher of reference. But when this Greek arrived, they don't only bring their Platonic expertise, they also brought indeed the idea of using this genre, the comparatio between the two mm-hmm. philosophers, in order to prove which one between the two could be the best ally for Christian religion. And this is when we start with, I would say, the Latin phase of the use of the comparatio. That happened precisely at the time of the Council of Ferrara Florence, when Gemisto Plito wrote in Greek a comparatio between Plato and Aristotle, aimed at proving that Aristotle was a liability for Christian religion, while instead Plato was its best defender in philosophical terms.
This was so fascinating. It was a great moment in your book when, of course, you start connecting the dots of not only the comparatio of Plato, Platonic versus Aristotelian thought, but also the way they align with political interests, the Byzantine versus the Latin church. And I found that really compelling. As we move to chapter two, you trace this comparatio, I guess, somewhat chronologically. And I wonder if there are some topics that stand out to you in the debate over authority, particularly given the importance of Neoplatonism to literary texts of the period. I mean, I'm going to be biased here, because here I have to admit, I can't help but think of the way the only comparatio that I myself have studied, the only reason this has come to my attention, why I've studied, is in the Questioni della Donna, where Plato and Aristotle are always held up sort of side by side in battle. And I'm wondering, you do mention, you know, you're really worried about or focusing on authority rather than the content of the debate, but I'm curious if there's anything that stood out to you during this period.
Yeah, first of all, one consideration is that I tried to limit my attention to texts which were actual declared comparaciones, no? That were described by their authors in terms of comparaciones, because otherwise, if we think about texts in which Plato and Aristotle are put into collision or tentatively in agreement, of course, we would need to investigate the entire philosophical corpus from the antiquity until our days in many respects. So that is why certain texts didn't enter in the book. But you are absolutely right that basically this kind of comparative approach is welcomed once it is made available in a number of other texts. And in a certain way, these comparaciones are instrumental in the development of texts like the treatises on love or treatises on beauty or those on the querelle de femme, for the simple fact that the main authority in those treatises is normally Plato. And The comparaciones were instead instrumental in bringing Plato back after this underground life he had during the Middle Ages. So there is also this kind of connection between comparaciones and text like treatises on love, beauty, and women that flourish, especially in the 16th century, precisely because it was thanks to the comparaciones that Plato was able to re-enter in many ways, to regain in many ways his legitimate role as co-authority of reference in the early modern period. And it's not by chance that in the moment in which we have the first comparaciones, we also have a new wave or reliable translations of Platonic works, even though we cannot forget even in this context that the Plato, which is presented by the comparaciones, and the Plato, which is interpreted and translated, is not the real one. It is, in fact, an author that has been mediated through a Neoplatonic filter precisely because he has to serve the agenda of the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, what also interesting is I think about these comparaciones. The authors that you were mentioning are sometimes the very same authors that will then write treatises that I'm more familiar with and that other, you know, listeners might be more familiar with on love or et cetera. Vincenzo Maggi. I mean, I'm thinking about some of the, that they author both of them. And so, of course, the bleeding in between these, among these texts is really fascinating. So chapter three really highlights the authority of Aristotle in the universities themselves, primarily during the 16th century. And I have to say, it's very impressive. You discuss such a number of unpublished and unstudied sources. Referring to your previous comment, there, I can't imagine you adding any more primary sources. So of course you could just consider things outside this genre. I found this chapter in particular very helpful because I've always been a bit unclear about how Plato and Aristotle were negotiated within the university curricula. I mean, we know the introduction of Plato and we know that this happens, but those of us that haven't studied it maybe as closely as you, it's always been a bit muddy for me. So maybe you could explain the various ways that the comparatio reveal the struggle for authority within the universities.
Oh, yeah. Let me start by saying that this was probably my favorite chapter to write in many ways, because it allowed me to spend time in Milan at the Biblioteca Ambrosiana that I absolutely cherish.
A wonderful place. Yes.
Oh, yes.
I completely agree.
Oh, so that was, you know, one of the upside of doing this kind of research. And again, you can think that these university Aristotelian texts are extremely dull, but it's not real. And this is what I've tried to show in this chapter. So normally when there have been discussions about the presence of Plato in the early modern period, Plato was found in this text we were mentioning before about love, about beauty, about the question of women, in text written in any case in a courtly context, or otherwise we have texts that we instead were written and cultivated in a religious context, and some of them are at the center of chapter two in my book. But Plato in the universities has always been a more complicated issue. Very little had been written about that. It looked like there weren't so many sources. So, you know, the assumption was, well, maybe there wasn't really Plato in the universities. And in a sense, it's true, because if we look at the chair of Platonism, which were activated during the 16th century, we will find very few of them. But and almost all, basically all in Italy also. But at the same time, if we look at the contents of Aristotelian teaching in the same period, we will realize that Plato is indeed very present. And is not present in an accidental way, but there is a deliberate pedagogical program behind it. So the first one to make a suggestion about using Plato for pedagogical purposes was this French philosopher, very interesting scholar, Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples. And for a few decades, nothing really happened. We are at the very beginning of the 16th century. And then in around 1540, this Milanese philosopher, Francesco di Mercato, in France, so evidently he realized there was an interest, an appetite for Plato in the French court, while teaching in French universities, decides to incorporate Plato as part of his lessons. The king is impressed, Francis I. We know that many people in Francis' court were very much interested in Plato. Probably Di Mercato also has interest in having a career, in obtaining an upgrade, a better salary, and so on. And but at the same time, he also is a very skilled philologist and a very capable philosopher. So he put together all these things and he start using regularly Plato in his teaching, in spite of not being a professor of Platonism. So his method of teaching is precisely by explaining Aristotle, constantly comparing him with Plato. There's not really a need to show that they are in agreement or in disagreement, but it's most of all important to show how different they are on the basis of their text. And what happens with this kind of approach? We have Envy Mercato is the first one also to have this kind of perspective, a secularization of the Aristotelian teaching, because it's true that in the moment in which you compare Plato and Aristotle, there will be always this kind of imbalance. Plato will always appear the theologian when compared to Aristotle. And so Di Mercato's reaction, also in order to defend Aristotle, that after all was the author thanks to whom he received the salary, is to totally diffuse these theological motives and to discuss philosophy just as philosophy, without any kind of interference from the theological sphere. This is important also because of the context in which Di Mercato is working. There is Petrus Ramos plotting against Aristotle at the very same time. But at the same, in this very same moment, this kind of approach developed by Di Mercato finds other teachers of philosophy, other professors, other magistri who are interested in teaching Aristotle via comparison with Plato. And of course, not everyone is offering the same solutions. Of course, many of these professors have a very personal and individual views. But at the same time, the fact is that Plato is incorporated into the university teaching, even when his presence is not necessarily institutionalized. When we have professor teaching Plato in an institutionalized form, therefore having a chair of Platonism, aside from the fact that this chair will be always short-lived, poorly paid, the course will be taught on Sunday, you know, in Die Festivo, so a lower rank kind of teaching, nonetheless, the need to adopt a strategy in order to speak of Plato, and for the most part, what they will do will be being extremely diplomatic against about Aristotle. They will not attack Aristotle. They will try to be as diplomatic as possible. Why? Because in those very years, at the end of the 16th century, there was the case of Francesco Patrizzi in Rome, who had a apparently important chair of Platonism, but because of his attacks against Aristotle and also because of his, let's say, revolutionary new ideas in terms of philosophy or reference for the Christianity, we basically bring the chair of Platonism in Rome to an end.
I mean, I found this moment, well, you've said so many things I want to unpack here, but this moment really important to think about, because academics love to talk about academic freedom even today. And of course, this has become such a real issue as our curricula is actually on the chopping block at the legislative congressional level with things like critical race theory and so on. But I think this moment's really interesting because you point to Francesco Petrizzi, who teaches Aristotle in a certain way, and losing his chair as sort of becoming the example that the other professors will then point to as why they, or at least your suggestion is, I believe, why they will teach Aristotle and Plato in a different way. And it's, you know, in order to, as you say, I think in your book, to retain their precarious chairs. I mean, it's sort of a job security coping mechanism, it seems, at least. It was really fascinating. I don't know if you want to speak more to that, or if maybe you've said it all, but that was really an interesting
For sure. Patrizio becomes the negative example. It's fascinating that after Patrizio, we have all these professors teaching Platonism who are extremely prudent when they're expressing their allegiance for Plato. They do it always by saying, yes, Plato is great, but also Aristotle was a good guy. They always make sure to point out that they have no bias against Aristotle. And this was precisely because Patrizio had been so vicious in his attacks. He wrote a work, very extensive work, in which he's trying to demolish the reputation of Aristotle by showing that he stole all his ideas, he was not original at all. He embraced all those conspiracy theories which were ongoing about Aristotle's myth as the most important philosopher, basically. And that's something that is not met with appreciation. At the same time, Patrizio has also idiosyncratic ideas. He's not simply a Platonic philosopher. His philosophy is really embracing all pre-Socratic authors and different kind of approaches to nature and metaphysics. But the problem is that by being so vicious against Aristotle, he basically rejects what has been the traditional authority of universities until that very moment. So the linguistic strategies that you find employed in these courses, taught in Pisa, for example, immediately after the Patrizio affair, are extremely interesting, in my opinion. Because, of course, many of these people are Platonists at heart, but mm-hmm. at the same time, they are compelled to do not destroy Aristotle's authority if they want to maintain their roles.
Well, you know, I wonder if you want to draw a line here too, because especially when you're looking at when we're talking about, we're, I believe, speaking about the mid-16th, towards the late 16th century. And if I mean, I can't remember exactly because I don't have your book in front of me, but the, and there's also many authors that you discuss, but what, I wonder if you want to draw a line here to what becomes really a culture of dissimulation in Italy anyway, or among the core. I mean, this makes, I just spoke with Paola Ugolini about her discussion of people critiquing the court and how, you know, specifically this concern with how one critiques the benefactor or the prince, right? In a time, especially in a time of absolutism, when there becomes, as you mentioned, sort of linguistic acrobatics. And also you mentioned the term prudence. While there's a prudence while teaching, of course, this term prudence becomes so important as we turn to the late 16th century. I don't know if you're seeing a cultural change more generally, or if it's just Francesco Patrizi's sort of counterexample as the one that they...
Well, you know, it's fascinating because Aristotelian philosophers, Aristotelian professors were actually in a very powerful position. Just to mention an example, at the beginning of the 16th century, the big problem was the immortality of the soul. So, and oh my God, we cannot discuss these things when we are speaking about these things in the university. We always need to have a disclaimer about fate. If you arrive at the end of the 16th century, this is not a problem anymore. Philosophers can discuss about the mortality of the soul, in their courses without being bothered, precisely because at the end of the day, as a lobby, let's use this expression, they were strong enough to face any kind of external interference about the contents of their teaching, even on apparently hot topic like this one, which was putting Aristotle in direct collision with the faith. But the problem was precisely that these philosophers were happy to present Aristotle as distant as they could from faith, because in the moment in which it's clear, it's declared, it's transparent that Aristotle cannot get along with faith, There's nothing to discuss there. We can all get along with our lives. We have just made this distinction, and there's no need to have any kind of external interference. But the problem with Plato was precisely that his philosophy was promoted as a sort of theology. Plato was presented like the author who went closer to the Christian truth. We have all this tradition of the Prisca Theologia and so on. So Plato was paradoxically, by being pious, more dangerous than Aristotle, precisely because he was seen like someone that could potentially bring to heresy. We have this anecdote that I also quote in my book, but it's very famous and is repeated many times, about Cardinal Bellarmino, was famous for his exchange with Galileo and so on, that while discussing with the Pope about the opportunity of having a Platonic chair, says, no, I don't want to have nothing to do with Plato, because Plato is dangerous, is so close, is dangerously too similar to Christian faith. So this is the real short circuit, in my opinion. The Aristotelian professor had been able to prove that there could be the right distance between Aristotle and faith. Many Jesuit philosophers embraced this approach, while instead, in the case of Plato, is the fact that his philosophy is seen too dangerously similar to Christian faith. And so this is why we have these philosophers teaching Platonism within universities that need to be careful about what they're saying, because they don't want to describe Plato as a sort of a Christian ante litteram on one side. And on the other side, in the moment in which they compare Plato with Aristotle, and that was something that happens often in many of the courses they teach, they don't want to be too antagonistic, because they realize who is detaining the power in the institution they're working. So we have this situation in which Aristotelian professors can basically say whatever they want, and they are not going to pay any particular price. But at the same time, we have instead these magistri who are in a much weaker position that really need to pay attention, because the philosopher they are handling with is explosive precisely because of his piety. It's a sort of paradox here.
It is a paradox, and I think you've just made your case of why authority is such a great lens through which to look at these works. I mean, fantastic. And I do want you to write for the Chronicle on academic freedom next, please. What an interesting just way to consider this. We have to move on, but I'm just really thrilled to hear that explanation. I have to say that, you know, I was really appreciating that explanation of the danger of teaching Platonism precisely because it is so close to Christianity. But that said, it's the next two chapters where I really had the most fun. I loved chapter 4. It was a lot of fun. Maybe this again is my literature bias, but you hear it's in chapter 4 where you discuss various legends about Aristotle and how they're manipulated by writers. And they include that Aristotle was a Jew, that Aristotle was a Spaniard, that Plato and or Aristotle insulted Moses. Fascinating. And finally, that Aristotle was actually a papist. So I have to say, I was generally unaware of these texts. I had heard, you know, maybe of vaguely some of the rumors Aristotle had been considered a Jew or something. But I found them all fascinating and really sometimes outrageous, particularly a couple of your authors. Maybe do you want to highlight the way that these stories were mobilized by authors to suit their own agendas? And I'm also really curious if you were surprised by anything that you found.
Oh, yeah, thank you. The Jew Aristotle and Aristotle as a Spaniard were a lot of fun, of course. The Jewish Aristotle was incredible because the way these legends arrived in the Latin world, it was a different... So it's an interesting legend because it has different genealogies. When it appears in the Jewish world, of course, is out of interest to show that Aristotle was the most important philosopher, of course, was connected to Jewish wisdom, and therefore there is a very there is a strong identitarian interest in supporting the legend. But when the legend arrives in the Christian world, it doesn't arrive through the Jewish sources, fascinating enough, but it arrives because of a typo in a 15th century book and an incunable because of a comma which is misplaced. And because of this misplaced comma, many authors, including Marsilio Ficino, read in that book that, yes, Aristotle was indeed a Jew. So we don't know, did he convert or was he born Jew? There are many responses also to this kind of question, of course. And the most fascinating case I've met in terms of the circulation of the legend was the one in Fortunio Liceti. It's the most fascinating because we are well into the 17th century, first of all. We are in a moment in which the legend had been debunked, at least in the Jewish context, because of Azariah de Rossi. But Liceti is so desperate to save the reputation of Aristotle that at that point is actually declining, that at that point is really suffering blows for a number of reasons. New philosophies are emerging. He's so desperate that his reaction in order to save the philosopher and the philosopher's soul is to make of him a monotheist. Because basically by describing Aristotle as a Jew, he has the perfect response which is also respectful of chronology to prove that Aristotle wasn't a Christian just for reasons of time, because he wasn't born at the right moment, but otherwise he would have been. So this is fascinating because we think that we had these Aristotelian philosophers like Vimercato who were trying to secularize Aristotle as much as possible. And yet, one century after, we have this individual trying instead to do the opposite, again, to save Aristotle authority. It's fascinating how different strategies can be at play in order to obtain the same goal. But what I found interesting about this legend was that once Liceti put it back on the radar, we have, again, Jewish authors that decided to incorporate it in their writing. So it's an interesting kind of exchange between one side or another, precisely because there was a convenience for both parties in supporting the reality of this legend. And it's one of those fascinating stories in which you see that philologists are listened to when there is a need to listen to them. But as long as a legend, a forgery is useful, we do not want to listen to philologists. So that is what I found very fascinating about this story. And again, I'm speaking of an example that span over centuries, like the case of the proverb about Moses. The final example in the chapter that you mentioned is this story about Aristotle as a papist. That is not something that has such a long and glorious story. We are speaking instead of a set of booklets written by this German Jesuit. And when I found them working in Wolfenbüttel and Munich, I found them so entertaining. They were absolutely amazing, printed on this poor quality paper, and yet so charming. And what I love about those books, in which Aristotle in a fiction is presented as a papist because he came back from the netherworld and he decided that the only true faith is only in Germany, and that the only true faith can be only the Roman faith, is that there were a serial. So we have Aristotle, this converted Aristotle, living several adventures and trying to convert Lutherans and Calvinists on different set of matters. It's really incredible. It's a sort of Nancy Drew. I don't know, maybe I'm not using the right pop reference, but in any case, it's fascinating that he has this sort of franchising basically developing. And the fact that this happens meant that evidently it worked. And it meant that in the German context, in which both Catholics and Protestants recognize Aristotle as an authority, that was why he was chosen as a bridge between these two parties, which were otherwise in conflict.
I have to say this, if I've got the right moment here, this man's logic was the one I found so strange, because his claim was that Aristotle would be a papist because the Calvin and Luther were such bad people, but the Catholic Church actually had ceremony. I can't recall now if there are the same pamphlets, but it was so strange. And I thought, did this work? I mean, but it really was an entertaining chapter. I mean, I guess this is something that you were unaware of before you started your.
Oh, yeah. So the name of this Jesuit, Melchior Corneus, was known when speaking about philosophy of science, about the reception of the ideas of Galileo. And it's not by chance that Corneus returns in the following chapter when I'm discussing Galileo. But these set of treatises weren't really studied. They've been completely ignored by scholarship. So it was very entertaining for me to work with them. But yes, what you were mentioning before about all these arguments he's presenting in order to support Christian faith, the Catholic faith above Protestant faith, both Lutherans and Calvinists, it's part of ongoing debates, because the idea was, and this was taken by other authors, of course, but that tradition and ceremonies and all these things that appear exterior to us were instead those decisive to show the superiority of the Church of Rome. So it can sound paradoxical to us, especially if we think about the perception of religion we have nowadays, but it was really an argument that had a lot of weight in the time of Corneus.
Well, he was a great way to conclude that chapter. I quite enjoyed it. The last chapter really is just so impressive, I must say. This is where I was just completely awestruck by the number of sources that you analyze, and you really analyze so many. And I think that most people would see them almost as unrelated, but what you do is you show this common thread of how these sources all have a trope that you call the "if Aristotle were alive" motif. And it really does work very well. It's just a beautiful gem of a chapter. So would you explain for us how these texts posit the question, if Aristotle were alive, and how that same motif will be used to suit really various needs of the authors, including Galileo?
So let me start by pointing out something. You're absolutely right that the text analyzing this chapter can appear unrelated to one another. On one side, this also happens because humanities are fantastic, because they're interdisciplinary. And when friends of mine heard that I was preparing this chapter, there was this very virtuous contest in looking for sources that might be useful for my chapter. So I'm glad that I've also involved my friends in this sort of crazy pursuit. But this is also what allowed me to present the treatment of this expression in so many different contexts. So I take this opportunity to thank these friends of mine who helped throughout the process. But yes, about your question and about how this expression was used. So I call it the if Aristotle motif because it's the normal formulation in which we find it. And the idea is that we have a sort of counterfactual imagining according to which Aristotle would be back from death. And once confronted with modern times, he would need to reconsider his ideas. And of course, this could bring Aristotle to marry different agendas. But it's also, in rhetorical terms, a very felicitous expression because Aristotle is dead. He cannot really take a position, but nonetheless, I can invoke him and his authority to support my own idea. It's very easy for me to say if Aristotle were alive, he would say I'm right. No one can contradict that. So it's really a useful expression and very efficacious in rhetorical terms. And we find it applied in different contexts. Some of them you can, of course, expect. So if you have authors who want to prove that Aristotle is a good guy, they will try to show that if Aristotle were alive today, he would convert to Christian faith. This is normally what we find in Jesuit philosophers, for example, in authors writing within institutionalized milieu like the university. There is the interest by using this expression to show that Aristotle would be one of us, basically. And he would admit his error in fact of faith, but aside from that, he's good to go. We don't trash anything of Aristotle. The only things he would need to change would be actually his religious allegiance. But more interestingly, but again, these are examples you can expect. But I find deliciously twisted the fact that this very expression is used by authors who are actively anti-Aristotelian. Galileo is one of them. And why do they use this expression? Why do they want really to receive the endorsement of this Aristotle back from death? Because by doing that, Aristotle, not simply with his authority, is supporting their agendas, but is also saying, look, I was wrong. So completely defusing the attacks made by the opponents of these philosophers, scientists, thinkers who were trying to go against the traditional teachings of the school. And when I say the word tradition, I'm not using it by chance, because of course, in the moment in which you invoke Aristotle and in the moment in which you want Aristotle's blessing, you are also showing that you are respectful of tradition. No one can accuse you of being a subversive of any kind. So it really works. And paradoxically, it works better for these authors who are going against the Aristotelian paradigm. So it works very well precisely for those who are working actively to cancel what has been the Aristotelian system of teaching and the Aristotelian interpretation of the world. So this is the delicious paradox, I think, at the bottom of the use of this expression. And I had a lot of fun working on the case of Galileo, because when in many other authors the expression is used as a rhetorical device, Galileo gives this expression a strong content founded on the Aristotelian text, and is showing that Aristotle was waiting for being corrected. he sees the opportunity. And what Galileo is saying is, Aristotle will welcome me as the best of his scholar, of his students, and he would reject instead these stupid, obtuse, self-declared peripateticians who haven't understood the real spirit of his philosophy. So it's extremely fascinating. And again, this expression is not used exclusively in this kind of philosophical, scientific context, but I found interesting also to investigate its applications in the field of philology, for example, when discussing the correct version or translation of or interpretation of a text. And in the final section of the chapter, instead, its application in the literary world, which is very interesting because Aristotle's Poetics is a late bloomer in terms of Aristotelian text to obtain circulation and recognition. And this is why this use of the If Aristotle Were Alive applied to the context of the Poetics and literary text will enjoy a longer life. We still find it, for example, in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say your passion for the Galilean texts it really comes through, and you can tell how much you enjoy writing about it. And I must say, because I was very convinced too, I said, yes, Galileo's right, as I was reading. But what I found particularly effective about Galileo's approach and then your analysis of it was that, and you sort of alluded to this already, is that Galileo is specifically referring to the Aristotelian method of sensate science, right? So of observation through the senses, and that is why, were he to have the telescope, or were he to have had the telescope, that he would agree with Galileo. I guess this was on the immutability of the heavens, but it just sounded like such reasonable and wonderful philosophy. I mean, it makes Galileo Galileo, right? And your passion for it was really obvious.
So. Well, you know, I mean, Galileo is from Pisa, I'm from Florence, so there should be some conflict. But the great thing about Galileo is that when he writes something, he always does it for a reason. It's never dullness. There is a point in what he's saying. And the real epiphany for me in his case was realizing that he uses this expression, if Aristotle were alive, several times, and he always uses it in the same context. So at that point, once I have identified that pattern, of course, was very exciting. It was just a matter to understand what he was doing. And of course, he had very clear ideas. And not by chance, in my opinion, is the author who uses the expression in the most effective way.
Well, you know, this is a great way to conclude, I think. Galileo is such a wonderful way to end. And I see that I've taken a lot of your time. But I would like, before we finish, if you want to tell us about what you're working on next.
So I'll tell you this. Of course, there are a number of small projects which are related to the book and that I'm bringing now to completion. One of them is indeed about the teaching of Platonism in the schools. I have a volume, an edited volume coming out about, again, the relationship between Plato and Aristotle in the early modern period, and other tiny Aristotelian things, but my husband is begging me enough with this Aristotle. So I want to make him happy. I want to comply, is right. And I have two projects that I'm currently developing. One is related to my first book on Porcio, and is about love sickness in the Aristotelian milieu. Normally, philosophy of love is seen through the Platonic lens, and I was interested into looking it from the Aristotelian side, and especially in the period of Counter-Reformation. And but the main project I would like to develop, and again, is in a certain way going back to my book on Porcio, is writing a monograph on the intellectual life in late 17th century, early 18th century Naples. It's something I was thinking about for a long time. There are amazing things in the Neapolitan archives that are still waiting to be explored. And I also would like to make these centuries, which have been quite forgotten, especially in the American university milieu, more known and appreciated. And especially a city like Naples, that in those very decades was certainly the most avant-garde city in the entire peninsula from an intellectual point of view.
Wow. Well, that sounds fascinating. And you'll have the wonderful chance to work in Naples now.
Tell me about it. Oh, my God.
So, Ava, this has been a real pleasure. So thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to these next, what looks like, two projects.
So. Yeah. And thank you so much, Gary. This was lovely. Thank you for having me. And it was a pleasure speaking with you. And I... very thankful for this opportunity.